I think you'll agree that pivotal moments in human history are usually centered on events. Unexpected but profound decisions that were made that change the course of history. That's what ends up in the books, right? But I think almost without fail, what precedes and sustains and marks those moments in history are words. Words are what spark decisions and what galvanize motivations and what forever ennoble that which ends up in the books, right? The history books are full of words. Words dominate human existence. The day that is being set aside tomorrow to remember this man who is on the front of your bulletin, that day is as much a testimony to the place of words as to the events that those words ushered in. It's difficult to make hypothetical statements about history, but you'd have to wonder, would things have transpired as they did had it not been for the words that he spoke and the manner in which he'd done so? It's hard to say, but it's profound. His words and the manner in which they were spoken catalyzed so much just by speaking them. They were spoken of wisdom, and they were spoken with wisdom. We started a series a few weeks ago on the wisdom from the Proverbs. We are going to take refuge in life that wisdom seeks to offer us, that the wisdom passages in the Proverbs are promising us. And the words that we're going to look at today, or rather the passages that we're going to look at today, all center on this theme about the use of our mouths and about the nature of words. And it's interesting to note that of all the realms of our person that the Proverbs addressed most, it's our mouths that get the most attention, for reasons that are probably rather clear to you from your own experience. We're going to look at several passages that are printed on this insert, and I think we're going to learn three things about our words from what the Proverbs say about them. One, their potency. Two, their provenance. Three, the point of our words. Their potency, their provenance, and their point. Brothers and sisters, I don't know that I'm going to say anything to you today that you haven't already heard or don't already believe. The question I put to you right now is, why do you need to hear it today? Only you can answer. So would you stand, grab your insert, let's read these several passages from the Proverbs. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. The tongue of the righteous is choice silver, the heart of the wicked is of little worth. The lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for lack of sense. With his mouth the godless man would destroy his neighbor, but by knowledge the righteous are delivered. By the blessing of the upright a city is exalted, but by the mouth of the wicked it is overthrown. An evil man is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous escapes from trouble. From the fruit of his mouth, a man is satisfied with good, and the work of a man's hand comes back to him. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who act faithfully are his delight. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. To make an apt answer is a joy to a man, and a word in season, how good it is. The wise of heart is called discerning, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. Good sense is a fountain of life to him who has it, but the instruction of fools is folly. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. A fool's lips walks into a fight, and his mouth invites a beating. From the fruit of a man's mouth, his stomach is satisfied. He is satisfied by the yield of his lips. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits. Whoever keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps himself out of trouble. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Wisdom grasps the potency of our words, the provenance of our words, and the point of our words. Let's talk about potency for a minute. The potency of our words. The fact that they have intrinsic power. Like most things that have power, words can be used for good or for ill. That's not news to you. Proverbs 18:21 sums up that characteristic rather nicely and succinctly when it says, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits." What it's saying is that our very words can effect despair, can bring forth hope. They can usher in darkness as surely as they can usher in light. And so in terms of words potency, there is potential for both peril and promise. How so peril? Most of the words we speak are to others. And therefore it is others that we are in peril of harming if we are not careful. What does it say in the first part of 12:18? It says, "There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts." It's talking about ill-chosen, ill-timed comments, words that are not just an error, words that become like weapons. When we're babies, we learn that there is a power in the pinch, or in the bite, or in the punch, even awkwardly thrown. We get that. But it is not long before we discover that there is even greater power in just hurling an unkind word. Without breaking a sweat, without even risking a bruise, we can bring a person to tears just by finding that right comment that gets them where they hurt, where they're weak. We learn at a young age intuitively about speech the same thing that the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said about words when he said, "Words are loaded pistols." They are. They're just words, but they can do damage without penetrating the skin. And you know that because you've either been the one to offer them or the one to receive them. And so we are always in peril of damaging someone else with the words that we choose, but we're also in peril of damaging ourselves. It says in 12:13, "An evil man is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous escapes from trouble. A fool's lips walk into a fight, and his mouth invites a beating." Those metaphors are so vivid, they almost don't require any explanation. But you don't have to lift a finger to provoke someone, to draw their ire. You don't have to do anything but say a word and you will later regret it. You have created the conditions not only to harm someone else, but to create more work for yourself now that you've done something that you're going to have to help fix. Just by speaking foolishly. By not recognizing the potency of your words. Now, again, none of that's new. About every month, it seems like, somebody says something on air or online without forethought, just a few words, something less than 140 characters, and bang, they feel the full weight of the internet upon their soul. Some ill-timed words are just radioactive. Like a kid who's just after hitting a ball knows exactly the trajectory of where it's headed for the pane glass window. Sometimes we say stuff, and as soon as we say it, we know, I'm going to have to ask for forgiveness for that. Because we forget about the potency of our words. So we all get that. Given the peril of words to others and to ourselves, you would expect that the Proverbs would instruct us in the art of restraint. And so they do. It says in chapter 10, verse 19, "When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. Whoever keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps himself out of trouble." Without some sort of governance over your mouth, the mouth tends to run wild, some of us more than others. And it's a fair bet that there's at least someone in this room sometime this week who forgot that and is now paying a price for it. And in what probably may be the most memorable metaphor that you're going to hear all day, it's something that John Calvin said that I put on the front of your bulletin. He said about the restraint of your mouth this. He said, "I consider looseness with words no less of a defect than looseness of the bowels." Take that home with you. It's true. And it makes intuitive sense. Everything that has power has some sort of safety mechanism on it, right? A gun has a safety on it. The car has a key that you have to pull out and turn on. NORAD has two guys 2 miles underneath the earth, both with their own codes, both with their own keys, so not one of them goes all Dr. Strangelove and starts lifting the rockets up on his own prerogative. Words are in the same class of power as those other instances, those other examples. So unless you recognize the potency of words, you won't know to hold some of them close to your chest. As Mark Twain put it, the right word may be effective, but no word was ever as effective as a rightly timed pause. Or as Winston Churchill said, we are the masters of the unsaid words, but slaves of those we let slip out. We could go on and on with all of these short little axioms, couldn't we? Why do they keep coming out? Because we keep forgetting. Wisdom calls for a mechanism on our mouth because there will always be conditions that require restraint when it will be tempting to speak anyway. Now, that's a beat down on words, right? They are perilous, but they're not only perilous. And you know that too. They also hold enormous promise. Like I said in the backstory this week, the fact that there is poetry, that there are such people as orators and authors, is testimony to the fact that words have power for promise and good. And the Proverbs testify to that same truth. Their promise is found in a sense similar to where their peril is found. It's what words can do to someone inwardly that prove their promise. And that's why it says in Proverbs 10:21, the lips of the righteous feed many. Or in 12:25, anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. There's a real sense in which a few fitly chosen words are enough to lift a soul or even rouse a nation. The glory of a film like The King's Speech, why is there glory to it? It's because you have a king who stammered greatly and therefore spoke awkwardly and yet was nudged and nurtured to speak with clarity and confidence, which is its own irony, right? Here's a story about a king who is anxious to speak at all, but he learns to speak in order to calm an anxious country on the brink of war. He didn't do anything but give a 4-minute speech, but the speech mattered because words hold promise. They nurture hope. As Aeschylus put it, words are the physicians of a mind diseased. They work something real within us, maybe only to help us exit the moment that we are trapped in. And so when it says in Proverbs 16:24, gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. Children get that. We adults forget that. Words to children can be as meaningful as any hug or as any gift that you give them. Just watch them. When you say certain words, it can make them wilt. It can make them stiffen their backbone with strength and courage. They confirm something that Elie Wiesel said a long time ago. He said, words can sometimes in moments of grace attain the quality of deeds. They hold us. They strengthen us. They have a measurable promise. And their promise is not just in the hearing of them. The promise comes in the speaking of them too. In Proverbs 18:20, it says, from the fruit of a man's mouth, his stomach is satisfied. He is satisfied by the yield of his lips. And then earlier in Proverbs 15, it says, to make an apt answer is a joy to a man. And a word in season, how good it is. It's saying that to find and to speak the right word at the right time is its own satisfaction. One that you would be remiss to forsake by not speaking. And therefore, it is not a waste of time to find a simple good word when the opportunity presents itself. And so while earlier we said that wisdom calls for restraint given the perilousness of words, it likewise calls for liberality concerning given the promise of our words. If so much peace and nourishment can be wrought through the mere saying of certain words, then there is no place for hesitancy sometimes. Because words nourish. But they do more than nourish. They do more than just encourage. They actually are a divine means by which He brings rescue. They are the means by which justice and mercy are wrought. We're going to speak more in the last sermon on the Proverbs about what the Proverbs say to us about care for the destitute and the poor. But in Proverbs 31:8, the last text of those sermon passages this morning, it unites that concern with the words we speak when it says, "Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute." Last week, we spoke about what the Proverbs say about the providence of God, how He works justice in His own way. But we also said that He makes us, in part, His ordained means of effecting His will. And what this last proverb in chapter 31 is saying is that our mouths are one tool in His toolbox as He seeks to bring provision to those that have great need. At the same time that you're opening your pocketbook, at the same time that you're opening your car door, or opening your home, or opening your skill set for one another, He also says, open your mouth. It's a tool. Don't forsake the tool. The potency of our words call for restraint. They call for liberality. What's the implication of that? Some of us in this room need to speak up rather than clam up. Whereas some of us in this room need sometimes to pipe down rather than mouth off. The question is, how do you know which is your greater burden? Which camp are you in? Stop snickering. How do you know which of those categories you fit in? Ask yourself this little interior question. What's come of your words most of the times? Is there more of a trend for regret for what you did say or what you failed to say? Do you find yourself saying to yourself more often, why did I say that? Or why didn't I say something? I ask the question rhetorically because there is always something driving excessive restraint or excessive speech. There will always be motives underneath our words or the lack thereof. And those motives matter. And they require wisdom. Which is why, yes, wisdom grasps the potency of words, but secondly, wisdom also grasps the provenance of words. All right. Open your Webster's. Provenance, not a word we typically use very often. It's not providence. It's the word provenance. What does it mean? It means the origin of something. The place from which it begins. It's a word that I find is typically associated with art, like what period or school of art did that particular object arise out of? What is its provenance? But it has wide-ranging associations such that I think it's fair to say that everything in heaven and in earth has a provenance to it. So do your words. There are two verses in Proverbs 16 that are virtually identical. It says in verse 21 and verse 23, the wise of heart is called discerning, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious. What it's saying is that the quality and effect of one's words turns on the character of one's heart. What we say is often a window into how we see, what we think, what we believe and what we value. That's where they come from. And that's why we read in our affirmation of faith today, Jesus' rather portentous words to the Pharisees. He's responding to their accusation that Jesus is working under the auspices of Beelzebub. And so he says, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you're evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. And here's where it gets up in our business. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. His warning is addressed specifically to Pharisees. But he's doing an anatomy class for everybody in this room. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. What is spoken bespeaks, or sometimes belies, the language of the heart. And that's why the first century Greek historian Plutarch says, in words are seen the state of mind and character and disposition of the speaker. Now, caveat. You can be over-medicated or be half asleep or in a delusional state, and you can end up saying stuff that is mostly disconnected from your deepest beliefs. Unless you're on anesthetic, and then sometimes the truth really comes out. And it's true that sometimes our emotions can provoke words from us that upon reflection we don't really mean. But even then, our emotions are rarely entirely severed from what we're thinking or feeling or believing. And so our words, even when exaggerated by our emotions, they reflect something deep within us. And so if we are quick to speak, and if we are long-winded ad nauseum, it is possible that there's a belief in our heart that we need to be heard. That we need to feel like we've been heard. And so the issue isn't so much our words or the quantity thereof, but our hearts. Whereas conversely, if we are those who never speak up for what is true, if we never share what's going on, while you might be commended for not adding to the noise level, the silence might not merely be a function of having nothing to add, but actually a function of being fearful of being rejected. Abolitionist and author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe, said, "The bitterest tears shed over graves are for words left unsaid." What we leave unsaid may derive in part from something in the heart that makes us hesitant to speak, and that may fill us with regret. But there's even a greater consequence in words unspoken. Worse than our feeling of regret is what may come to others as a result of our silence. In one of his Massey lectures back in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. said this soberingly. He said, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." The silence that's born of fear or of mere political calculation is actually deafening to those who needed someone to speak up for them. But again, that's not an issue of quantity of speech or the lack thereof. It's a function of the provenance of the heart. And so if our words have their provenance in the heart, then our attention has to be given to the heart. The fact that our words have potency doesn't mean that you and I are supposed to focus on saying more or saying less, as the case may be. What we have to do is focus on the why we're saying too much or why we're saying too little. Why are we drifting into gossip? Why are we known for using brusque, defensive, dismissive words? Why are we preferring only the most superficial words to reveal ourselves? Those are the questions of the heart. But even if we consider the heart, even if we find the reasons to why we're speaking as we do, that may only be an explanation of the problem, but that doesn't solve the problem, even though it's important. Yes, my words as they come from my heart may reveal the pride or the fear within it. But what's going to renew my heart so that my words might be tools of renewal? That's where we get to my third and final point. Yes, wisdom grasps the potency of words. It grasps the providence of words. But to work renewal through our hearts and our speech, wisdom has to grasp, if you will, the point to our words. What? The point? You and I have to recognize that there is a purpose, not just to every single individual word, but a purpose to all of our words. And the question is there such a thing? Is there an overarching point and purpose to everything that we say? I think there is, and I take that from what I find in those two verses in Proverbs 12, verses 19 and 22 specifically. Look there one last time. He says, "Truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who act faithfully are his delight." Both of those texts are on their face extolling the virtue of speaking the truth. Not complicated. None of the Proverbs are complicated. That's clear. But those two aspects together, those two texts together, rather, I think provide a single point with two aspects. A point to all our words and the purpose of them. What one factor is this. Words are uttered in an instant, but their intent is to last forever. To speak about what is true forever, what is real forever. If what is true is that which is real, then what is true is what's going to remain, what's going to last. What they put in granite are words that we have deemed words that should endure forever because they speak of truths that are not tied to the moment but are of a universal significance. Words, I'm suggesting from this text, have the purpose of speaking that which endures forever. Part of the reason that you and I hold politicians in great suspicion and in low regard is that they tend only to speak of what suits the moment, but in a way as if it were universal, when they know it's not. In truth, what they often say is for their own protection, their own preservation, their own calculation. If speaking a universal truth will cost them and their agenda, then they tend not to speak it. They speak of what's true of the moment, but not what endures. It's not true for all of them. The point of our words, in part, is to relate what lasts. But at the same time, the point of our words is to bring delight to God. Verse 22 makes the stark contrast between God's appraisal of deceit and of fidelity. The former, he abominates. And the latter, he celebrates. Friedrich Buechner said this about false words. Lying to God is like sawing the branch you're sitting on. The better you do it, the harder you fall. If it's true that we're made in the image of God, and if part of that image extends to the fact that we speak, then as what God speaks endures and takes delight in, then what we're to speak is to bear the same character. Which is all to say, the test of our speech is whether it conforms to what endures and whether it's something in which God would delight. That's the point of all our words, no matter what context, moment, age, stage, station you are. And even as I say that, if that's the test of our speech, friends, if we rolled back the audio MP3 on your life and your speech thus far, who of you would pass? And given that our words often betray our hearts, what's the likelihood that me just saying that that's the test of your speech is really enough to renew your heart henceforth? It's low likelihood. So how do we begin to pass that test? not for the sake of passing a test, but for the sake of delighting in the God who gave us mouths and the gift of speech. Jesus Christ came to us in himself, but he came to us with words, with good words, with good news, news that he gave us in his teaching, but news, brothers and sisters, that he also gave us in his dying. It's by his cross that he's going to renew our heart so that it might renew our words. How does he do that? The cross of Jesus is going to humble us when you get it. It decries just how deep is the dark heart in us. In fact, the cross is inexplicable apart from that truth. If we just need a good pep talk, then the cross is just too much drama. You can't get the cross until you see how it's there to humble us. And it's in being humbled by his cross that you and I will learn to restrain our lips from using words that might damage. And for the words that have damaged us or damaged others, it's the cross that will humble us enough to find words of contrition so that we can begin to restore what we've broken through our words. That's what the cross does to us in humbling us for our speech. It gets to the point of our words by humbling us. And then it does the same by grounding us in his love. What Jesus endured was for love. His decision not to speak when he was ridiculed and interrogated and tortured was for love. And his willingness to suffer the silence of God was for love. And it's in knowing and believing that his love for you is real that you are freed. That you are freed to speak the truth in love, even if it means that you're going to be met with disdain. It's that love that will free you to speak words of love when you're afraid of what might come of it. When the crowds began abandoning Jesus in the wake of his difficult teaching in John 6, Jesus asks the 12 if they're going to leave too. Are you out of here? He says in so many words. At which time Peter says to him, Lord, who else are we going to go to? You have the words of eternal life. By our faith in Jesus Christ, we become the delight of God. We obtain the delight of God. And in having that delight, we are no longer tempted to use our words like a weapon. But in fact, we're inspired to use our mouths like a tool in his hands. We begin to speak with restraint and liberality as the moment may call for it. So, brothers and sisters, I'm asking you rhetorically, what needs to be said by you? Who needs to hear you say soon, I love you, thank you? Who needs to hear your regret for the things that you've said that you wished you hadn't, things that you wish wisdom would have instructed you to refrain from saying? Who needs to hear you say, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? It may start there. Given what words fitly spoken do to both the speaker and the listener, you need to say them as much as they need to be said. And so let me close with a quote from Blaise Pascal. Kind words do not cost much. They never blister the tongue or lips. They make other people good-natured. They also produce their own image on men's souls, and a beautiful image it is. Folks, church, no kinder word has ever been spoken to us than the Word made flesh. And it's in the kindness of God through the suffering of Christ that makes us his delight. And when we know that we are his delight, we will speak what delights him. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.